Never fear, Blake, because there is another show on the stream sites from Amazon Prime Video. It is known as The Tick, and we spoke to a couple of the stars, but I think the only way to introduce them properly is through your movie voice, Blake.
Here we go.
In a world where superheroes exist, one man knows the baddest and worstest supervillain is still out there, controlling the good folk of the city. But who will believe him? Enter The Tick.
Very excitingly, we are here with Ben Edlund and Griffin Newman, the creator and star of the new Amazon Prime Video original, The Tick. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing us into your... I assume this is your home?
Yes, it is our home.
Okay, cool. It's beautiful, isn't it? Nice place. A lot of equipment.
Yeah.
A lot of equipment.
A lot of windows on the inside.
Well, we have to have some semblance that, you know, there is an outside world.
Yeah.
When
yeah.
you're, like, yeah. three rooms deep into mm-hmm. your office.
No. Hi.
Hi.
Welcome to Oz.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And yeah. congratulations on the series. Oh. It's a scream. The first few episodes that we've seen, anyway. It's an absolute scream.
Great. Thank you for watching it. Thank you for paying any form of attention whatsoever. I appreciate it.
I mean, this has been your baby. You created this back in the 80s.
Yeah.
So, how was it? What was the original concept when you came up with it all the way back then?
I mean, in a lot of ways, it came from the same sort of seed concept of, I mean, at that point, I was reading comic books, reading superhero comics, and there were a lot of, I mean, it was, superheroes were very important to my burgeoning awareness, and the idea of having fun with them, still loving them, but sort of making fun of them and having fun with them started to just be something that made a lot of sense to me. And I grew up in kind of semi-rural Massachusetts where there's just a lot of ticks. So, I mean, that's just... Actually, my dad, who... All right, two parts of it. One was, I think, my dad was very influentially odd man who kind of helped with the just general bed of absurdity from whence the tick sprung. But then, and a good example of that is, and that tying into ticks, I'll be quick. you know, he used to keep a jar full of gasoline on the kitchen windowsill during the summer, and we would have dogs that we would be pulling the ticks off of, a lot of ticks, and then you would put the ticks in the gasoline, like building a Molotov cocktail over the course of the worst one. That's not how you want to go, by the way. Covered in a flaming bath
a tick
of gasoline
bomb.
And tick.
Yeah.
But no, so it would, by the end of the summer, it would look like a jar full of olives and gasoline, and that was pretty traumatic. So anyway, you know, ticks and superheroes sort of found their way to meet, and a humorous notion about, like, taking on the totemic kind of, using the tick as your bat for Batman,
yeah.
You know, and the idea that even in the 80s, it was so far, that I thought it was funny, so far into the superhero, you know, kind of saturation of our culture that, wow, you've run out of names, and you need to go all the way down the list of scary animals to tick. The, you know, tapeworm is the next one under it. Anyway, so that was the beginning.
I don't know if I've ever told you this. My mother had, like, very, very severe Lyme disease, had, like, a real intense bout of Lyme disease.
Holy crap, that's
so I feel like,
stuff.
Yeah, I never... Like, you're saying your whole reason for picking the tick was like, oh, what a comical, ridiculous thing. And I think by the time I found out about this property, I was like, yeah, ticks are as scary as Batman.
Like, really instilled
brought
fear.
My family to its knees.
Right. And that's, yeah. Man.
We had, like, a long planned trip to Disney World. I was one of those kids who was constantly pushing to go to Disney World. When we finally went on the trip, my mom had, like, come down with Lyme disease. So my dad would take my brother and I out to the rides.
And she was hotel bound.
Yeah, we'd just come back and she was lying. It felt like it was like Wuthering Heights or something. She was just lying in this hotel room with the lights off. And final day, we rented a wheelchair.
Right.
And we were able to skip the lines. And it was like, you can pick three rides that mom goes on. And I was pushing my wheelchair down Mother around Disney World so happy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That gives a tremendous depth to your performance.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the grounding. Every actor needs to have a secret in their performance. Now
man,
I've spoiled mine.
That's a real strange association with
yeah.
all of that.
But I've never viewed it as like a comedic idea.
I know, right.
I find a lot of things funny about the show, but the fact that he's a tick, I'm like, right, terrifying.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You bought that entirely.
Wholesale.
And that, you a criminal, that would have thrown your heart into a quiver of panic.
The heart of danger.
And it's perfect because it just plays into the dead seriousness with which that you approach this role. Like, it's like, it's like if you are there being complete, you just buy in that this is a serious landscape.
Yeah.
So I love about this property and about your current adaption of it is we are absolutely at superhero saturation. And I feel like you need, I feel like the Tick is like the cold bucket of water that appears every sort of decade that says, hey guys, just, can we just not take ourselves so goddamn seriously for just a half minute? And it's okay. It's okay. Was that like was that part of the gestation and sort of the desire for this new project specifically?
I think that's how it feels to me. It does. It seems as though this level of saturation with superheroes, we're at the point of reaching a kind of fatigue level.
Yes.
And I would have thought that, and that's what's strange about the persistence of this is,
we were going to hit fatigue 10 years ago.
Yes, and then 4 years ago, and then 3 years ago. Like, we were developing this. I was sort of working out the pilot and sort of working on different versions and trying to work out the engineering with Amazon for about 3.5 years, about 3 years. And I thought that we were already going to be, we're going to miss it. We're going to miss the crescendo and just be like commenting on something that had happened, but we're still, it's still widening and widening. And
I very distinctly remember like 9 years ago in 2008, reading a ton of think pieces of like, I think this is
right. The tipping point. We're done now.
Right. Yeah.
The pendulum swing.
Iron Man has happened.
And
the Dark Knight came out together.
No, but I remember reading those pieces before those two movies came out. And everyone was like, I think this is the last year of superhero movies. And instead it's the two movies that like completely set the next decade in motion. Yeah.
Right. So a very, yes, I would say the Tick was called into service almost. That's how it feels, more or less.
Yes.
And we're doing a weird thing with the energy that drew us here, which is like trying to also take part in all of the, because the Tick only exists because I'm an enthusiastic enjoyer of hero fiction.
It just won't quit.
Yeah, and like it's, yeah, so it just comes back and it wants, this is the one where we want to take the most seriously, the thing we're making fun of, and it makes it for a very interesting soup.
That's what I think is so interesting about this sort of reconceptualization of these characters that Ben has come up with in this world, is that, like, on one hand, we're kind of throwing cold water in the face of all these so-called serious, you know, or self-serious superhero properties. But on the other hand, I think there's a very, very pure, simple, classical idea of superheroism at the center of this show.
Yes.
You know, it's not superheroes fighting other superheroes or fighting a hole in the sky or fighting their own
doubts. Or a blue light into the sky is my favorite.
Right. It's like the Tick is like what you kind of think of superheroes being when you're six.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah,
so it's like,
he has that Peter has that wonderful line. It's like, heroes are the soul for villains.
Oh, right.
And it's just like, that is that synthesis of that. Perfect.
It's just we've gone so far, like all the way around, like so hot it's cold.
Yes.
That now doing the most classical version of a superhero is weirdly the most like countercultural.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like the cold bucket of water is like, oh, remember they used to like stop people,
save people,
doing bad things.
They were nice. They liked being good.
Yeah, they liked people.
Yes.
Like that's a big deal with the Tick.
Why do these people want me to save them all the time?
Darkness
in my brain won't let me sleep. I've got to.
Okay, but do you like people?
Yeah.
What are people?
Yeah.
What is the point? Even
what is so?
Well, this is the third iteration of this coming to the screen. I mean, you've had the first. It was the comic, and then you had the cartoon. And then you had another live action, and now this. What separates this from the ones that you have tried to adapt it previously?
Time. No. well, a lot of things. I think this environment is, like we're saying, is a very different one, an unexpectedly kind of fertile sort of bed for what the Tick might want to do. The approach, we have a different approach. I think, you know, each one is made of the stuff of its time.
Mm.
So and of its medium. So the cartoon was Saturday morning cartoons of its time, and it was made of the same stuff, almost literally, like across the hall they were making X-Men. Like Larry Hughes was making X-Men, and we were doing The Tick. We were using the same companies. We were using the same animators. So we were of our... And so that... And then the live action was kind of its time, which was like live action cartoons were of that moment. Like, and so it kind of...
In the era of Scooby-Doo, I'm thinking. Like, the Scooby-Doo live action Flintstones.
And all of these things sort of had this... I mean, you could list like the... Like, it just went down the list of all these things that... were sort of the first flush of probably people who enjoyed it as kids being in positions of power and trying to express these things again in some way.
And not caring about novels. You know?
Yeah, right.
Saying, what should we adapt?
What can we adapt? What did I learn as a child? Well, not very much.
But I always say that it's like Ben's job, weirdly, as you know, the keeper of this Tick flame, has been to hold up a funhouse mirror to whatever's going on in superhero culture at the time. And so it's not like, well, let's bring the Tick back because there's a fan base to do it. It's like,
hey, guys, get in the pool. Superheroes are hot again.
But he's like, he's making a Tick that he couldn't have made 10 years ago or 5 years ago, you know? And if we get to make more and more seasons of this, I think the show will evolve as the superhero culture evolves around it, because it really exists in a dialogue with, you know, what we're all kind of accepting as the norm in these stories.
I saw your pinned tweet. I have to talk about it.
Yeah.
That you said your Michael Keaton's hair gives you faith that one day you'd be able to play a superhero.
September 2014.
No, 2013. 2013, which is...
Nailed it, baby.
Yes. Yeah. My question is, if you make more of the Tick, am I going to see you in a black sort of turtleneck at a long table? And I'm asking Ben as well, a long table eating cereal while Peter's at the other end of the table having some cereal.
Can I show you, and I have not rigged this up, my background on my phone. My background on my phone is, for the listener at home, it is the first shot of Michael Keaton in Batman Returns, his character introduction after we've had the whole Penguin prologue.
Black turtleneck.
Right. He's sitting there in the turtleneck.
In a high-topped leather chair.
Deep in thought, and then you see the bat signal be activated.
Yes.
And it reflects into his window, and he looks up, and it's this incredible moment of, oh, wow, this guy is so sad and so lonely. He's in a giant house. He's got all the money in the world, and if he's not being Batman, he doesn't know what to do with himself. And that's one of my favorite moments in all of superhero culture, in any medium, in anything. I just felt like that was such interesting distillation of a real guy put in that situation.
Yes.
And like 5 years ago, probably around the time of that tweet, a little bit before, I was drinking with my friends and talking about how much I love Michael Keaton and pulling up pictures of different things. And I was like, God, I'm going to just make this a background on my phone. And I woke up the next morning, and it's the only time I've ever felt good about something I did when I was drunk. But he's always been this North Star for me. He's kind of like, you know, when people ask you as an actor, like, so whose career do you want to... It's like, that's an impossible question, you know? And so much of acting, it's like opportunities. It's about what's being made, you know? I dreamed of being able to play Arthur, but I didn't know if they were ever going to do the Tick again. If they did, if I was going to be at the right point in my life to play the role, you know? But Michael Keaton, just the amount of different sort of genres he's been able to exist in, how long he's been able to, you know.
Just keep going.
Right.
And diverse roles, too.
Right.
Like, I saw a great picture the other day, the blessings of the internet and Photoshop. Someone photoshopped his Beetlejuice next to Heath Ledger's Joker, sort of looked like he was talking to him on a couch. And I was just like, that's such a perfect thing. Mm-hmm. They've got the black eyes. They're both insane. It's just, it's excellent.
But I always, you know, like the Michael Keaton Batman was the one that felt like there was no way I was ever going to get to do that.
Yes.
That felt like such a weird anomalous event that he got to play that character.
Insanity.
You know, totally insane. Because even like when Chris Pratt is like, oh, he was a sitcom guy, but then it turns out he had those cheekbones underneath. And, and he becomes a very conventional leading man. And Michael Keaton was always doing something very weird in those movies.
Yes.
It didn't really feel like he fit, and the hair thing was a reduction of that, you know. But I have like weird curly unruly hair, and I remember watching that and just going like, you know, rewatching one of those two movies for like a thousandth time and going like, they would never let someone with hair like that play a character like this again.
No, and they wouldn't let a guy be like, his take on the character was exactly that moment, which is, this guy's insane.
Right.
This guy's like, he's got a problem. Like, he's the kind of guy that does pick up the the sort of the fire stoker, the metal fire stoker, and try and attack someone in a room. It's such an interesting performance.
How many episodes of the series have you seen now? Have you gotten to see?
Four.
Okay, so there's a moment in episode four that I directly steal from that, from Michael Keaton with the fire poker, which is, I think it got cut down a little, so I don't know if the full line reading is in there, but it's I'll keep it vague for listeners who haven't seen the show yet, is when I'm facing an antagonist, I'm backed in a corner in a hallway,
right,
and a villain is coming towards me, and I grab a vacuum cleaner. And go like, come on, you know. I want to get nuts. Like I don't say, but I do whatever I say in that moment.
I'm only going to hear you in my mind. Yeah. It's like people who thought they saw the ear get cut off in Reservoir Dogs. Yes. I'm now going to see you doing that.
I'm directly stealing line delivery and physicality from him in that. My whole performance is just stolen from Michael Keaton. But I think you know, the thing that was weird in that movie is very cartoonish and self-serious. It's cartoonish and dramatic.
Yes.
And not self-serious, but dark and brooding. And he had this weird idea to play him as like a lunatic, as like a really unfulfilled kind of guy.
With a real like psychological kind of truth going down.
Right.
And in that craziness.
Right. Yes. And that was, you know, it was written, it was baked right into the cake from the way Ben wrote Arthur in this version. But what really excited me was the idea of, I've auditioned for so many sort of like, you know, because of how I look and what have you, most of the roles I end up auditioning for, mm-hmm. these sort of latchkey people or people who are the butt of the joke or struggling to, you know, get respect or whatever it is. But very often it feels like that character is written as a punchline.
Yes.
You know, without any sort of real compassion and without really any integrity for the person, even if they don't have that much integrity. It bugs me when I see like writers or actors clearly think the character's a nerd.
Yes.
In addition to the world of the property that treats the character like a nerd. Yes. You know? What a loser, this guy I'm writing.
Is that really necessary?
Right. And I you know, for
you would
years,
think they would love him. Ben writes Arthur with love, though.
That's the thing.
And the tick loves Arthur.
For years, I would audition for these poorly written things, and I would go in and I would try to play it like a real person, and they'd go, okay, what do you want? Congratulations. Come on, it's a comedy. Bigger. And they just want you to like throw the pie in your own face, and I'd always get so bummed out. Mm. And I read this script, and I said, like, well, I know how I'd like to play it, but what are the odds they would let me do that?
Yes.
And then I sent my tape in, and Ben was like, yeah, that's what we want to do. And it just felt so bizarre that it was like, oh, you actually want him to be a real guy in the center of this thing.
Yes.
And trust that the comedy will come out of putting him in those circumstances, the juxtaposition, rather than having to play it comedically.
Yes.
You know?
And I love that there's that sincerity in your performance, but on the flip side, you get the villains, and they are just like bickering siblings.
Sure.
It's so, it's a great juxtaposition, because like villains aren't going to be nice to each other.
Right. Right. And I feel like a lot of times when I come face to face with a villain on the show, it's kind of just like, it's like a kid in high school just trying to reason with a bully. Just kind of, please, come on, don't do this. God.
Like, the introduction of the terror was just him, like, eating a kid's ice cream.
As evil as you can possibly.
Pretty basic. Pretty basic bag. That comes right out of the first page of the bad textbook.
You will eat a kid's ice cream, and badly eat it, too. It's pouring down Jackie O'Leary's
face. Most of it just
guzzle.
Stuck in his mouth.
You have to guzzle it if you're really going to, No, that's it's funny. That is a sort of that scene where Arthur loses his dad is a kind of, for me, was a sort of a codex of tone. And I think for a lot of people watching the thing, that's one of the, in the first maybe hour of watching, there's a couple of key moments where certain areas are sort of staked down. Like, okay, tremendous tragedy will be depicted in this show.
Yes.
With almost a tone-deaf sense of what's going on. We're trying to get comedy out of the worst things and doing, like, you know, and that's part of life that felt like real and sort of an interesting area to hit. And then I think the hug between, I guess, I don't want to spoil.
There's a hug.
Occasionally there's some hugs. Yeah. I mean, there's like moments of emotion that are sort of like important key things to kind of land. And then we needed to throw some blood around.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So like Yeah, there's a map that's kind
it's
of
setting the parameters of like where we're able to go in the show emotionally and tonally and, mm-hmm. and viscerally and
yeah. I mean, yeah. this has been it's. I'm not even sure what the question was. I apologize, but this has been a real rare chance to kind of play a lot of interesting games with that stuff.
I think the only thing that I regret is that there's not in the world of streaming services that there's not a channel playing the Tick at the same time that there's a channel playing the more sort of well-known properties perhaps that are on at the moment, like the Defenders. Because
yep.
I think one thing I adore is if you flick the channel, the aesthetic, sometimes it feels like the same city and it feels like the same thing. And then sure. you're like, what the hell am I watching right now? Right. If I'm seeing these really self-serious characters, I wish there was just this...
You'd like someone to be able to stumble into that environment.
I would love to see someone who didn't know what the Tick was accidentally lean on their remote, flick into it after being midway through, say, like a Daredevil and go... Wait, right. what's going on? Well, no, I would love that.
Is this an X-Man? Hang on.
Wait.
Is he bright blue? Yeah.
But you're speaking of this very big difference in how we process TV now. Because
yes.
it's an art form that now viewers approach with a lot of intentionality.
Yes.
TV used to be something that you would like discover by accident.
You would come through the trees and you would say, oh, there's a watering hole with it.
And now it's like a commitment. I'm going to watch 10 episodes of this thing, even if I don't think it's very good, you know? A lot of people I know went, I watched the first 2 episodes, it was bad, but there are only 8 more. And I go, 8 hours? You kept going for 8 hours?
Yeah, no.
But I think, you know, I think a lot of the legacy of The Tick and the two previous TV shows, which have these rabid fan bases, which I was a part, still am a part, is that it was like a show that you would turn on. And if you had a certain kind of sideways brain and sense of humor.
Yes.
And had that sort of read on the conventional. Sort of accepted tropes of this sort of storytelling.
Yes.
You just be like, what is this? Is this, am I reading too much into this, or is this show actually on the wavelength I think it is? You know?
It's like a dog whistle.
Yeah.
You just hits this weird frequency in your mind. You're like, wait.
Did that happen?
Yes.
And especially with the cartoon. I mean, I feel like, you know, I talk to people and they either go like, oh, I was so hugely into that show, I would watch it with my parents.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That was the only Saturday morning cartoon show that my parents wanted to watch with me. And they tried to explain to me what it was doing, why it was interesting, you know? Or you got, I'll talk to people who went like, yeah, I never watched it because I just thought it was the same as those other ones.
Yeah.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Which was kind of like, it was like...
A compliment in a sense.
It's a sheep in the grass kind of thing. Like, you had the aesthetics and you were on this landscape mm-hmm. where X-Men was down the hall, you know, and literally sharing, like, neighbors with you on the time slots. And
I think that part of the value of the Tick at that time and maybe part of what you're regretting or what we all regret in a way is you... It allowed us, and I love the notion of a sheep in the grass.
I said sheep in the grass.
I love it. I love
grass,
it. I don't
want to
change it.
Predator.
I don't want to change it.
It's a
like,
hungry sheep.
I was like, I'd never heard that before. I love that.
If that had, you know, nefarious designs, you would never suspect it.
Right.
It's a sheep.
It's grass, kind of a big sheep.
Perfect
big
sense.
Blue
and then
sheep.
They shivs you. That sheep. But the notion of, like, the judo flip of you come in with one set of expectations, which Saturday morning, those were very... scaled down expectations, and when weird stuff started to happen in the course of the experience, which was the Tick's whole reason for being practically, like, it was really a hiccup in culture. Like, you were like, wait a minute, is this, like, I had the same experience before the Tick when I was younger watching, Ralph Bakshi and John Cristofolusi's, Mighty Mouse. And, like, that to me was like, is this allowed to happen?
Yes.
It was very freeing. And, you know, I think that nowadays this level of intentionality, there is something that's a little bit, you don't get to stumble
into
this situation.
It's kind of an incredible experience. I mean, because I know I had those sort of formative shows for me where it would feel like, wait, there's someone else in the world who thinks the same way I do?
This
you know,
was, that's a huge thing for people looking through the glass into, like, the outsider.
Right, you're a weird sort of isolated kid, and you just flip through and suddenly catch a line of something or an image of something, and you went,
all
like...
All it took was a line.
Wait, so in order to write this, someone else had to have the same sensibility that I did, and then other people had to work on it, too, and people had to improve it to be on the air.
And with an animation, they drew it.
Lonely.
Right. There were people drawing this to hit that line.
Right, it's
it means a lot, and that's actually, in a large way, the experience I am caught up in replicating...
Yes.
For an invented version of myself who is constantly out there somewhere, it's that signal connection that I had when I was younger that is that's what I'm into. Yeah. I think that's what I think we're all probably into.
It's like a homing beacon. Like, weird kids, come over here.
Yeah. And I think...
Echolocation.
Yeah.
And I think... not to spoil, we did sort of skate along. There is a hug to be had.
A big hug.
A big hug.
Great hug.
In this show. Yeah. And in the first four episodes, in the second episode, in fact. And I think that is almost one of those, like, despite the intentionality, which is like, oh, for God's sake, will someone give this guy a hug?
Yeah.
And when it happens, you're like, Did someone hear my brain? Because sometimes you want, I suppose that's like the collective yearning that people have in some of these shows. It's like, oh my God, this brooding guy, just give him a hug. Right. Seriously.
Can he tell his secret to that person, and can they just get along now and everyone be okay?
Right. It's like,
or let's change the dynamic. Let's just give him the hug and see what happens, for God's sake.
Well, like the Lego Batman movie, which I loved, is like after 75 years of like kind of avoiding what's going on in this dude's brain, the movie is just like every character saying to him over and over again, like, you're not happy, are you? You know? And I think, you know, you imagine in a more traditional landscape where you would be flipping through the channels and would suddenly just see a giant blue guy crushing a kid in a poncho while the strings swell around them, you know? It just feels like it's a weirdly transgressive image, I think, because of how vulnerable it is.
Yeah.
You know, and how human it is amongst all this, the craziness going on around us.
And also just, it still is oddly, it's unusual in hero fiction, which is a male-dominated sport.
Very true.
To allow for two men to have an unguarded emotional experience that's physical, platonic.
Any intimacy whatsoever.
Compassionate.
Compassion.
Empathic. It's weirdly not... That's transgressive. The cartoon used to be based on the idea that Dick and Arthur were like... When a little boy finds another little boy and they have their best friends.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's okay to hug. It's okay to be basically... affectionate with that person because there are none of these like sort of layers of stigma that are about maledom.
Yes.
It's really, I'm happy that this came out the way it did, and I feel
everyone who sees it reacts very strongly to the hug.
Yeah. Me too.
Even it, like when we
guys
shot
are
it.
Good huggers.
Peter deserves a lot of credit. He's Big Spoon, I'm Little Spoon.
Hey, the Little Spoon is very important.
Do it with one spoon, that's obvious.
But that was like maybe our second or third day of filming, and we were still fighting paparazzi a lot that first week.
Yeah.
At a certain point, they stopped coming around because they were like, oh, it's the same guy wearing the same suit every day. There's nothing new to get photos of. But those first couple of days, we were getting a lot of paparazzi. And the guy, when we were shooting the hug, was like a foot away from us.
Right.
And he got this photo that ran in like the tabloids the next morning, and the paper was all over the internet. And a lot of the people who were like very fanatical about our pilot when it came online had seen that, were waiting for the full season to come, really latched on to the hug.
Yes.
And there's been this like hug fan art since like March, you know, where they haven't even seen
God
the
bless
context.
Tumblr.
Some of them were even joking, like, is this actually part of the show? Or was this just in between takes?
This
like, what's
just
going
a lot
on
of
here?
Cast affection.
But I think there's something kind of odd about that image and how genuine it is, and we don't undercut it with any sort of joke, you know?
No, there's no joke. It's very sincere.
Right. Yeah. Mm. And I think, you know, not to speak for Peter Serafino, which my lovely co-star who is not here is sleeping, I think. Lucky guy. He always says the thing that he really loved reading the script is that like the Tick is like this big powerful guy, and then he meets Arthur and it's like a 6-year-old on the playground. He's like, I want him to be my friend. You know, and I have a lot of reasons to push the Tick away defensively. Yes. You know, he's thrown a lot of crazy stuff at me and a lot of really extreme stakes. But he's really adamant about, like, no, I like you. You're going to be my friend. And by the end of the full 12 episodes we have, you know, the six that are coming out now and the six that we've shot are coming out a little ways away. I think it's really
reasonable to give away the spoiler that a friendship emerged.
Yeah, we just like by the end of it, we're such genuine friends. You know, it really is a partnership, and I always say it's like a romantic comedy. The show,
because
it is like we're two people who don't really know how to function without each other,
and once
we do, we just enter some kind of flow state. You know,
I also kind of like the way you talk about mental illness because it's just like I need to take my meds and just get on with the day. And that's what a lot of people try to do. And it was just so genuine. So how was it kind of exploring that aspect?
Yeah, I mean, I love that. You know, I love that. I think so often when you have a character who is neurodiverse in some sort of way, you know, has some sort of character chemical imbalance or what have you, that's the entire story. You know, their entire character is defined by that, and the entire narrative is really about that, you know, or they're a joke or they're a villain or whatever it is. You know, they're just meant to be a figure of pity or fear or sort of mocking, you know, humor, whatever it is. And this is just, it's a very big part of who he is, but it's a part of who he is. It's not the full definition of who he is. And there was, when the pilot came out last year, and, you know, Amazon Prime Video does this thing where they put the pilots out there to get a sense of whether people, there's an interest for the show before they commit to making more of it. So Ben and I were just like obsessively both, we were in Chicago for a comic convention, we're in our hotel rooms, respectively refreshing, looking at
the They had just released it,
yeah.
So we got the first flush of of fan response to the pilot.
And I found this Tumblr post that I thought like made me cry, and I sent it to Ben immediately about, it was someone saying, I've struggled with mental illness my entire life, and I've never seen a show like this that has a character who is neurotypical in this way and isn't the crazy one. You know? Like, he's fighting this thing. He's figuring out how to live with this thing. More than anything, he's fighting the perception of how people view him and write him off, which I think is a story that's not often told enough. You get, you know, sort of stamped with the big crazy on your forehead, and then people treat you with kid gloves and tell you, well, just lower your expectations. You know, there's the line my mom on the says on the show says, and also my mom in real life says, which is like, you know, good is great, honey. Good is great. Like, he's been told, don't expect greatness. If you can achieve good, you know, a really boring, functional good, you're going to be okay. And I say a lot of stuff like that when I'm sort of doubting Tick in these first couple episodes. You know, my family doesn't want exceptionalism. They want stability. You know, that sort of stuff. And I think, especially within the comic dynamic of the Tick and Arthur, Arthur is the straight man. You know, he's not the crazy one. And
no,
I think
very
it's very exciting to be able to tell that story and just have these things exist on this spectrum.
It's nice for the routine. Like, just like, I'm just going to take this. And it's going to be fine. And then we'll move on to the exceptional later. That's not, it's so refreshing.
I mean, that's
His
starting point. I think another thing that's, that feels like we've found a way of expressing the idea that it's his capacity that we're kind of playing with. It's not that he's, the times around him call for a certain kind of misshapen comet of action and like preparedness. That whether or not you would call that sanity at the moment is not of purpose.
But that's another thing
that's
I love.
A continuum.
Is that he's not a hero because of his mental illness. It's
not
like that's not a superpower. And he's not a hero in spite of his mental illness. It is an element of who he is.
Just
in the same way.
It's a part of who he is.
That any other character, their job, you know, what foods they like, you know, how they dress. It's part of the tapestry of everything in his entire life has been leading up to this moment.
Billionaire, playboy.
Truly, you
mental
know?
Mental illness.
But that's what I love about it. Like, he's the sum of his entire life and his experiences. You know,
we have to wrap it up now. Out of time.
This was fun. Out of time.
This was a really nice talk.
So good. Yeah. Congratulations. We can't wait to check out the full six and then later in the year. But
cool.
It's so nice to hear that Tick dog whistle again. So we hope you guys keep making the hell out of this show.
I hope we
our
do.
Our antennae
too.
Are up.
They're up. They're up.
They're twitching.
It'd be very nice to stay employed. So hopefully, people, you know, enough people hear the whistle.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having us. And we'll try and keep making more.
Yeah, and a lovely home you have here.
Oh, thank you so
once
much.
Again.
Thanks for having us.